And I want to thank PI for the invitation to come give this seminar. So start by just sort of explaining what this title means and sort of give a schematic introduction. And so first word cluster refers to the rather large body of math literature concerning cluster algebras. And let me know if this is too small for people way in the back to see, because I've got plenty of blackboard space. So cluster algebras are a relatively recent construction by Fomin and Zelovinsky in early 2000s. And they've really exploded in popularity since then. And there's sort of belief that they're a very, very fundamental type of mathematical object that's really deserving of study. Both in mathematics, and then we're starting to see also in physics. I'll introduce actually what the topic is later, because it might not be very, audience members might not be familiar with it, but it's very interesting and can be described to first order relatively simply. So that's cluster. Polylogarithms, of course, refer to another large topic of mathematical study. And these are much older than cluster algebras, but they have a nice large body of literature about them as well. And in particular, most recently, one of our collaborators, Sasha Goncharov, who's a mathematician, has done a lot of work in this field. And they're basically the study of the structure of polylogarithms, which are essentially iterated integrals of logarithms. And these are very interesting from a physics perspective because they're sort of the natural outcome of loop integration. And so these two mathematical fields, again, have huge literature, but interestingly, their intersection is almost zero. There are some examples of interesting connections between the two, but it's really not actively being studied, and until now, seems like there'd be not a whole lot of reason to study it. But I guess the point of this talk is that scattering amplitudes, in particularly, I'll be talking about n equals 4 Yang-Mills, everyone's favorite toy model for scattering amplitudes. And in particular, I'll be talking about a specific case, namely two-loop MHV for n particles. So this is an infinite class of functions, and they all live really beautifully in this intersection. So n equals 4 Yang-Mills, amongst its numerous gifts, apparently provides an infinite class of functions which beautifully marry the theory of cluster algebras and the theory of polylogarithms. And so the motivation for this work, in some sense, is twofold. One is to use these functions that n equals 4 Yang-Mills provides to study the intimate connection between these two mathematical fields and sort of motivate more study of this connection, and then vice versa, use this connection and use the structure of cluster algebras, use the structure of polylogarithms to inform our calculation of scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 Yang-Mills. So the bulk of my talk will be introducing these two apparently disparate mathematical fields, and then at the end I'll try and sort of marry them with some examples from n equals 4. Any questions before I begin? So again, most of this is going to be kind of almost pure math. And so I guess I apologize for that. Okay, so as is sort of necessary, when we're talking about scattering amplitudes, really the first thing we need to talk about is kinematical data. That's sort of what describing what we're actually scattering. And so we're talking about momenta of n particles. So these are our variables, essentially. But these are, of course, not free variables. We have the non-trivial momentum conservation. And then we also will be talking about massless particles, namely gluon scattering. So we have that these momenta have to be null vectors. So these two constraints actually carve out a very interesting sort of submanifold in momentum space. And we'd like to characterize precisely the submanifold so that the variables in our scattering amplitudes are completely free, and we don't have all these constraints sort of implicitly in our functions. And of course, so this problem was solved not very only recently, surprisingly, with the use of what are called momentum twisters. This is a construction due to Hodges, Ender Hodges. And in a nutshell, because the underlying definitions here aren't that important, essentially momentum twisters are objects which live in projective space, and that there's a construction involving projective space that allows you to basically solve both of these constraints very, very beautifully. And so in particular, our kinematic data that we'll be dealing with are essentially going to be a collection of four vectors. Now, this is some 4 by n matrix. And so this is in GR for n, or the Grassmannian of essentially k planes in n dimensions. So 4 by n matrices here. But n equals 4 Yang Mills, we have a conformal field theory. And these are also going to be ordered points here. So we essentially have an overall PGL4 that we're symmetry that we're going to mod out by. And just as a point of mathematical rigor, we like to say then that our kinematical data is conf NP3, essentially a configuration of n points in P3. And so this is the kinematical data that's going to enter into our scattering amplitudes. And so to generate kinematic invariance, we create these four brackets, which look like this. And this is simply the determinant of the 4 by 4 matrix, that. And moreover, we actually want to consider cross ratios of these four brackets. And that's sort of going to be how our kinematical data enters into the scattering amplitudes. And now I have to figure out how these buttons work.
Sorry, just a very basic question.
Yes.
Why is it not just Grassmannian of 4n? By definition, Grassmannian, isn't it the space of planes? Doesn't it mod out automatically by this?
I think importantly, if we have the ordered points, and I think also the overall conformal invariance is in the PGL4, and more importantly, these guys that we're in some sort of projective space, so it's not we're not dealing. The actual kinematical data isn't just GR4n, but it has some character to it.
Can you explain why it's not GR4n? Sorry, I did not get it. So GR4n, it's n planes in 4 plus n dimensions.
Sure.
So giving these vectors, why isn't it exactly giving that? Being projective is just being planes?
Yeah, I think that doesn't take into account the conformal symmetry, though.
Conformal symmetry is just rotating these vectors, right?
These
vectors doesn't change the planes that they span. So why isn't it automatic?
I guess I don't understand the distinction. So let me just come back to it later.
Then. Yeah. What is PGL4?
But it's projective linear group. So acting on the left with PGL4 should leave this in invariant. This plays no role in the actual story moving forward. So we're just essentially, you can just think of this as GR4n. That's just a minor technical point, but it doesn't play any role really in what happens. It's fine to think of this as just a 4 by n matrix, which is our kinematical data. So perhaps I should just ignore that technicality then. Okay. It's the easiest thing to do with technicalities is to sweep them under the rug, right? Okay. Let's see here. Okay. Okay. So essentially, again, the objects, the kinematical data enters in as cross ratios of these four brackets. And the natural question is, what are the functions that those cross ratios will be arguments of, right? We want some function describing the scattering amplitude. And it's going to be some functions with cross ratios as the arguments. And so as I was describing earlier, those functions are polylogarithms. What are the polylogs? So simplest case is they're defined recursively which is seeded by Li1, which is just log. Okay, so these are just simple generalizations of the logarithm to sort of higher and higher values. So these have been known since Euler, at least, they have some very nice properties, which I'll get to in a bit. But there's also more generalizations which have been introduced more recently. For example, there is what physicists like to call the Goncharov polylogarithm, which is. Is this too? I think you can see it. Hopefully. So here we have, instead of just some weight k, call this the weight k, we have a weight vector. And then you have, again, some essentially iterated integrals here over the different weights with these poles, essentially, as your kind of, again, you can think of these as propagators, essentially, for loop amplitudes. And so this defines the whole space of polylogarithm functions. There are other more complicated generalizations. And so to keep them separate, we refer to these as the classical polylogs. And guys like these are non-classical. So you can prove that in the space of polylogarithmic functions, there are very precise mathematical statements that I could be making here, but I'll be very vague instead. You can prove that there are these polylogarithmic type functions, these multiple general Goncharov hyper polylogs. There's a lot of different names. And then there are the simple Li functions that form a nice subset. So these are the functions that we'll be dealing with. So what are we actually going to compute? What we're going to compute is amplitudes. And in particular, we're going to be computing something that's called the BDS remainder function. So BDS remainder function is quite simple. Essentially, it's a guess for what MHV loop amplitudes will look like. So again, MHV is maximally helicity violating. So you have two gluons of one helicity. And all the rest are opposite helicity. And so these are essentially the simplest non-trivial amplitudes in n equals 4 Yang Mills. And based on some observations about the exponentiation structure of loop amplitudes, Byrne, Dixon, and Smirnov made a guess for MHV loop amplitudes to all loops. And this guess is conjectured to be correct for 4 and 5 particles to all loops. And it's sort of by definition true at one loop. So the first non-trivial case, however, is at 2 loop 6 points, it's known that the BDS ansatz is not fully correct. And so the difference, essentially, between the actual amplitude and the BDS ansatz is called the BDS remainder function. And so this will be denoted R LN, so loops N, and it's always MHV. And so this object is actually very nice, particularly because the BDS ansatz takes into account all infrared divergences of n equals 4 Yang Mills loop amplitudes for MHV. And so this object is a completely finite, it's a completely nice object. One thing is that It's a collection of these polylogarithms, and importantly, it's uniform weight. So what I mean by weight is this this index k, or this vector here, and it's essentially the transcendentality of the function. So for example, log or pi, transcendentality 1, and as you integrate up, you get more and more transcendentality. And in particular, the remainder function has transcendentality 2L. So in the case we'll be looking at, 2-loop, it's uniform transcendentality 4. So every term that appears is uniform transcendentality. And this might sound trivial, but it's a very, very important feature that allows us to use some powerful tools. And so what does this function look like? So in 2010, this was first calculated for 6 particles. Again, this is the first non-trivial case. And it was given to some of these Goncharov polylogarithms. The downside, it was given as a sum over 17 pages of Goncharov polylogarithms. So the paper that presented this result was like 200 pages, and the result was 17 pages. And this is the simplest non-trivial case. And this was done by Del Duca, Dur, and Smirnov. And so the feeling at this point is, if this is the simplest non-trivial case, and it's 17 pages of very, very complicated iterated integrals, then we should probably just give up, because n equals Fourier Yang Mills is hopelessly complicated at the most trivial case. And that was certainly the feeling until a few months later, a group of my collaborators, Mark Spradlin, Anastasia Volovich, and Christian Vergu, and Sasha Goncharov, came along and wrote this exact same formula, but in a new form that looks like this. Right, can people see this? It seems like it's quite faint. So here we see some simple cross ratios. Okay, so this is much nicer than 17 pages. This is basically a line. Now note, I have some dot, dot, dots here. What I'm leaving out is a relatively short collection of products of lower weight. So this might be Li3 times log, or Li2 times Li2. But importantly, the arguments are only drawn from it's either this or this, throughout Li3s and logs and Li2s and log to the fourth and pi squared log squared. But it's relatively simple. You can literally write it down on a line. And this is the GSVV formula. OK, so what happened? Were Del Duca, Dur, and Smirnov just having a bad day and didn't notice that they could write down their 17 pages as a single line? No. The problem here is that both just polylogs, just the LIs, and also the Goncharov polylogarithms satisfy numerous functional identities that are incredibly non-obvious. For example, one of the simplest identities amongst Li3 involves 40 terms. And that's one of the simplest. So you can have really long expressions that are secretly equal to 0, and it's not at all obvious how to prove that they are equal to 0, other than by, plugging in some numbers and seeing what you get. There is some powerful mathematical technology that is able to clarify this, and it was used by GSVV. And that is known, I guess I'll change this. So what's GSVV used something called the symbol. Okay, and the symbol, if we can think of polylogarithms, the ring of polylogarithms as just, let's denote it by AK. So again, this is just a ring of polylogarithms. It takes AK to basically a sum of a k-fold tensor product. Okay, so we have, I won't explain it exactly what these xi are here, but there are some arguments. It's basically a bunch of logs tensored together in their different terms. Okay, so why do we care about that? Well, what's brilliant about the symbol is that it actually turns all of the complicated functional identities up here into completely algebraic identities here. In particular, if you can imagine something like this guy, this ratio, entering in the log, then you can expand, you know, log AB is log A plus log B. You can expand all that out, and you get, if you plug in the 17 pages of GPLs, and you take the symbol, you expand it all out, and 99% of it all cancels. And again, this is, you can't see this at the level of functions. You can only see it at the level of symbols. And so in particular, just as an example of what a symbol looks like, okay, so again, weight 4 goes to a length 4 tensor product, and I'm just dropping the logs because they're tedious to keep writing. So again, you can sort of think of the symbol as taking some complicated iterated integral of d logs and basically stripping it into the component logs that you had to integrate together. So it really kind of reveals some of this iterated integral structure. In a way that makes the functional identities manifest. So again, there's this great power in that it lets you basically take the 17-page result here, take the symbol, and then you can rebuild it, make it stronger, make it better into that form. And this is a very, very powerful technique. Other things. So this is not. So this is. This is one example now of a scattering amplitude. This is the simplest non-trivial case, but this is pretty well understood. We have an honest-to-God function that we can actually basically know this is the shortest possible representation. It's very beautiful, the natural question is then what happens at higher points or higher loops or non-MHV. So at higher loops, there are functions that are known in the literature. They're quite complicated, and so I won't talk about them. And same for non-MHV. There are results, but they're complicated, and I can't describe them in this talk. But there is a very nice set of data for two loops at endpoints. In particular, the symbol of R to N. So any number of points is known. And this is by result of Caron Huot. So this is calculated shortly after these results.
Doesn't he also know the function numerically because he knows what to integrate?
Yes. So they're
computed numerically, right?
Yeah, you can compute these numerically. I think even before Simon, this was known.
Before Simon?
I think so. Yeah, I think there are numerical approaches for two loop. But I could be wrong. But we have a nice, so we have an all n formula for the symbol. And we also have an all n formula for the differential. So this is literally like a d log times Li 3 or something like that. And that was work done by myself and Mark Spradlin. So we have some idea, really, of this all n structure for the two loop amplitude. And it's very tempting to sort of try and analyze this structure and analyze this result and look for structure, try and understand them, maybe even try to write formulas down for these actual functions. But that isn't necessarily the main goal. The main goal is just to try to understand the structure. But here we run into a problem, which is that the symbol is essentially atomizes the function, right? It takes some very dense iterated integral, and it atomizes, breaks it up into its smallest bits, the logs, which is very nice, again, because it makes these identities manifest. But it has the downside of your expressions are huge. they're not human readable. You can't look at a symbol. Even in this simple case, the symbol is only really machine readable. And example for it, 7 points, the symbol has 27,000 terms. So you can't look at it and say, oh, I see what's going on here. So ideally, you know, you can think of this as really, you're atomizing it, you're removing all the structure. And so you kind of want to deal with some object maybe that isn't the function, so you don't have to worry about all these hidden identities. So something that's reveals that, but has more structure than the symbol. And for that, there we go. Okay, so I guess we can do one more. Sorry, I do not understand all this. Okay, so in particular, we don't want to work with the symbol. We want to work with something called the coproduct. And the idea behind the coproduct is exactly the idea behind the symbol, but instead of breaking stuff down into the smallest possible component, the logs, let's just take it one rung down the ladder. Let's kind of strip off one d log rather than four d logs. And then that leaves us with something that is simpler to deal with and actually will still make the functional identities more manifest. And so in particular, polylogarithms are known to satisfy Hopf algebra. And there's an associated coproduct, which literally just sort of takes you down the rung of that, and then the coproduct applied enough times will give you all the way down here. But there are other sort of strata. But the problem, or one problem with the coproduct in that case, this is the there's two coproducts here. There's capital delta, which is the Hopf algebra. So this is very nice, and other people like to use this. But one problem when you try and work with this Hopf algebra is that the Hopf algebra actually it sort of maintains knowledge about all these log to the fourth terms and pi squared log squared and all that stuff. And that there's a lot of that stuff, and we take the philosophy that that's not that interesting. Okay, the stuff that's interesting is this intrinsically weight 4. Okay, this is where all the structure is. These are the most highly constrained, and this sort of tells us the most about the amplitude. And the other stuff, the factors of pi, we can figure that out later. It's not nearly as interesting, and it sort of hides a lot of the structure because there's so much noise, it's the sort of noise from the background of the logs. So we don't want to deal with that. So instead, we have a new coproduct, delta. And delta essentially is this Hopf algebra. It's taking us down one rung of the ladder, but also annihilating all of the log terms and all of the Li 2 times Li 2. And so this essentially clarifies precisely the intrinsically weight 4 portion of the function. So in particular, actually, so we don't want that guy. We want delta. And delta is associated with a Li coalgebra, which I can clarify in just a second. But so first of all, instead of dealing with this general ring of polylogarithms, we want to work with LK, which is just AK modulo. This stands for both pi and products. Okay, so we're modding out all of the log to the fourth, log squared, pi squared, all of that stuff. We're just going to ignore that. And then this delta here, so delta is going to take us from L to L wedge L. And you can think of this capital delta would take us to L tensor L, and this small delta takes us to L wedge L. And that wedge essentially is what's killing off all the lower weight stuff. This is a very hand-wavy argument, and there's ways to make it mathematically precise, but this is a, again, sort of an intuitive argument.
I have no idea what this problem means. Can you elaborate a little
So I'll explain. Yeah, with, I'll give an example. Yeah, so in particular, what does this look like? Okay, so for L4, which is the case that we are working with, so at L4, essentially, if we act on the with the coproduct, we get two different types of objects. In other words, there are two different ways to add up to 4 with two integers. You can get 3 and 1 or 2 and 2. You can think of this as taking some Li 4, okay, and tearing off a Li 3, and then there's a remaining Li 1 or log. Similarly, you can separate it into a Li 2, a wedge of Li 2. And so again, this is it's very much like kind of, you know, just stripping off, instead of having all these logs, treating these as some complicated Li 3 or something, and then just having a log at the end. And then you can keep going down the ladder, actually. So these guys both go to L2, and then all the way down here, you get wedge to the fourth L1. And again, if you replace the wedge with the tensor product, you get tensor to the fourth L1, which is just the symbol. Okay, so again, the capital delta reproduces the symbol, but this smaller delta has this wedge in place.
What are these arrows?
So this just means you this is some map. So delta, if you hit delta on L4, you get an element here and an element here. And you apply delta again, and you get some elements in this space. This just maps the spaces that delta maps you to. But I'll give some examples. So for the general statement is that some element, give me some function f in L4. Okay, so this is some collection of Li4s, Goncharov polylogarithms of weight 4. It's some complicated weight 4 function. And it is uniquely identified with some element A in L3 wedge L1 and some element B in L2 wedge L2. So rather than talking about complicated functions, we can instead talk about simpler objects that live in these spaces. Again, you can think of this as Li3 wedge Li1 and Li2 wedge Li2. So what's an actual example? So delta on Li4 has two components. So the one component would be the Li3 wedge Li1. And this is quite simple. It's just you could write it as minus Li3 of Z wedge or wedge Z. So again, I'm not going to write log. We instead of writing Li3, which again gets cumbersome, we actually just write it as these brackets sub 3. So this is the Li3 wedge log component of Li4. And now delta on Li4 has another element in L2 wedge L2. But in this case, it just happens to be 0. So there's essentially no way that you can sort of tear off a Li2 and a Li2 out of a Li4. You only have Li3 tensor wedging with a log. So there are more complicated examples, though. Let's keep it visible. Now I can't really. Okay. So now, for example, delta on one example of a non-classical polylog is Li 2 2, which is basically some form of Goncharov polylogarithms. And if you hit that with delta, you get some complicated thing that looks like this. You get, so again, this bracket just means Li 2. So that's simple, but then you also get something more complicated like that, and you get a few terms. But importantly, what you get is shorter than the symbol, and it has this nice sort of collection, and you can think of this I mean, really, you like to think of this as Li 2 comma 2 is very similar to two Li 2s wedged together, but you get some other terms that kind of pollute things. So the rule is essentially I can show you the rule. For example, delta. So let me just write, instead of writing a function, you can think of this as an element of the symbol of a function. So delta here for Li2 wedge Li2 is A wedge B wedge C. So you anti-symmetrize in this way. And that represents delta, the L2 wedge L2 component for the symbol. This is not strictly like correct in that delta acts not on the space on the symbol space, it acts on L4, but this is how it kind of acts on the symbol. And the precise rules are in one of our earlier papers on motives. The coproduct has, and there's a similar anti-symmetrization rule for the L3 wedge L1. This coproduct has one more really important ingredient, and that is the fact that if you look at the object delta squared on F, which is delta A plus B, is 0. So delta squared on any element of L4 gives you 0. You can sort of think of this in a hand-wavy sense as delta kills lower weight stuff, right? It only lets L4 survive. And once you've operated on with delta once, you're just left with stuff, I like the hockey stick. So you're just left with stuff that's just lower logs. And so when you operate on delta again, it kills all that. But that sort of hides some of the magic, because if you give me some random element in this space, or some random element in this space, and you hit it with delta, you're not guaranteed to get 0. You are only guaranteed to get 0 if the element A and B correspond to a function in L4. So another way of saying this is the cohomology is trivial. Right, there's no A plus B. They satisfy this what we call an integrability constraint. Then there is a function F. There is a unique function F, modulo products of lower weight, and vice versa. So for a mathematician, F, some function, is completely equivalent to this element A and this element B. So that this is an exact correspondence, but with the benefit of on this side of things, these functional identities that I warned you about are very clear. They're very easy to work out. They're not quite as easy as a symbol, but it's very near to that. And so these are some sense the more invariant ways of talking about these weight 4 polylogarithms. And there's extensions to higher weight, of course. So again, the real key statement is that this coproduct, these elements in these two spaces capture the most interesting part of the function in a very nice invariant way. So that's about as rigorous as an introduction to the coproduct as I can give, given that I still have to introduce cluster algebras. OK. So any questions? So
Does L2 have a 3×1×1 component?
Yes, it does, and it's long and it's too long to draw.
What kind of manipulations are we allowed to do with this coproduct? Like in a symbol, we can add them together.
Yeah.
How does it work?
So here, basically, you have like the Li 2 identity, the 5 dialog identity, that it operates here. So I could replace this particular guy with a sum of four different Li2s, and the, or which would be these two bracket things, and you can expand that out. And so essentially, the very complicated functional identities of the Goncharov polyalgorithms are reduced here to just identities of dialogues, in the case of L2 wedge L2. But that's all you get is just the dialogue identity. That's enough. Okay, so here is a lightning introduction to cluster algebras. So the easiest or most succinct way I have found to describe them is that cluster algebras are some set of variables, which we call cluster coordinates. And they are grouped in disjoint sets, which we call clusters. And these sets and these coordinates, they satisfy relations. Via a process called mutation. Okay, so that's a lot of jargon, which I'll try to clarify in a bit. But the key statement is that cluster algebras, well, so actually let me get back to the code product for a second here. So for in an earlier work in last year, a bunch of my collaborators and I, we calculated essentially, what did we calculate? We calculated delta, this coproduct of R27. So again, R26 is known. Let's calculate. We don't want to calculate R27 right away. Let's start with the coproduct. And so we calculated it. And what did we see? We saw, okay, for example, let's just talk about this L2 wedge L2 component. And we saw a bunch of things that look kind of like this. Where again, instead of putting the numbers here, these are just the similar kind of type of cross ratios appearing, as in the 6 case, as in the 7 particle case, as the sort of arguments of our Li2s here. Okay, and this is actually really surprising. There's no reason why these couldn't be arbitrary algebraic functions of these cross ratios. And same here. There's no reason why they have to be this nice. Again, these could be super complicated square roots of cross ratios, you know, any kind of thing, any algebraic function. That's fair game. But you only get just cross ratio. And we saw the same thing happening at 7 particles. We only saw cross ratios. And the motivating question is sort of try to explain this or understand this in some way. And our math collaborator, Sasha Goncharov, in his infinite wisdom, said, hey, I've seen those before. They are cluster coordinates. Okay, so this was the first clue that cluster algebras came into things. So in particular, so this kinematical space, which essentially is just GR4N, has a cluster algebra associated with it. And I'll make this statement a bit more precise in a bit. Okay, so there is a cluster algebra that's essentially related to our kinematic data. And in this case, there are these cluster coordinates appear. And there are actually two types of cluster coordinates, which let me just say to be precise. There are A coordinates for general cluster algebra, but for GR4N, the A coordinates are just these four brackets, okay? So you get these four brackets and you get some combinations of four brackets, which we understand very well. But basically, it's just four brackets. And they're also what are called X coordinates. And that is just these cross ratios. So you can just read a math paper, basically. And this will tell you here are the x-coordinates for GR4n. But the key is that not all cross ratios are x-coordinates. There's actually a very, very precisely defined and fairly small collection of these cross ratios that satisfy these relationships in such a way that they can be called x-coordinates.
What is the criterion?
So I'll describe the rule in just a second. But the simple, actually, a simple criterion is that, and this is kind of heuristic, I think, is that this cross ratio has to be positive when evaluated in the positive domain. And 1 plus this ratio has to then be, you can combine it via Plucker relations to form a new cross ratio. So 1 plus x is a cross ratio, and x is positive in the positive domain. But that's a hand-wavy physicist definition. There's a more precise mathematical definition, which I'll get to. So the story is that... Oh, just I don't think it's proven. I don't know. Yaroslav says he's proven it, maybe, of the positivity. That all x coordinates are positive in the positive domain.
I thought you were saying that this was a definition.
That's a physicist definition. But there is a math definition, which I'll get to. This is more an observation. We've calculated the x coordinates for GR4n up through n equals 9, and in all cases, all of them are the entire case, they're equal to the set of ratios which are satisfy the conditions I just gave you. And so we conjecture it's true to all n. So we have some finite set of x-coordinates, and it's not at all obvious why they should appear as the arguments of these Li 2s and the Li 3s and the logs. And it's a very interesting statement that this cluster algebra on the kinematic domain sort of permeates through to the level of the function. But in fact, if I have time, I'll try and tell you that there's actually a lot more of the structure permeates. Okay, so let me actually describe, let's give a brief example. Of actually what a cluster algebra is. So the simplest example of a relationship is this. It's defined some set of variables, the xi, which satisfy this very simple exchange relationship. Okay, so we can calculate these. You have to start, of course, with at least two that we just call x1 and x2. But from here, you can sort of recursively generate more. And this is, you know, terribly simple algebra. But amazingly, something very nice happens is that the sequence ends after 5. So starting at 6, you return back to where you started. Okay, so we have these nice 5 coordinates, which we call the x coordinates, and so this exchange relationship essentially generates these coordinates. Now, what are these clusters I'm talking about? Okay, so a cluster is actually defined by essentially what we call a seed quiver. And that looks something like this. So the 1 over x1 is a minor point, which will become clear in a second. So this seed quiver represents a cluster in our cluster algebra. And to generate new clusters, we do a process called mutation. So what is mutation? Well, mutation works by acting on a node. So this is node 1, this is node 2 in your quiver. And I'm just going to pick node 2, and I'm going to mutate on it. So what does that mean? It means you get a new quiver diagram, which looks like this. Okay, so you can sort of see, obviously, what's happening with this mutation rule. The mutation rule inverts the node that it was acting upon, and then it takes this one to i plus 2, and then the arrow flips direction. Okay, now we can mutate again to generate a new cluster. Although if I mutate on node 2, I get back to where I started. So mutation is involution, so we don't want to do that. Let's generate something new by mutating here on x3. Okay, so what do we get here? Well, we get 1 over x3, of course, and we get x4. Okay, so now we can just keep playing this game. It's very simple. 5. And then amazingly, we get back to where we started. There's a slight discongruity here because the arrows, this was actually goes to 1 over x1 arrow to x2, but you can just flip it, and it's isomorphic. So so we say that this is the cluster algebra, okay? We have these 5 clusters, which are labeled by 1 over xi goes to xi plus 1. And these clusters have 5 x-coordinates, and that is the cluster algebra. Okay, so this might not seem very exciting, but you can consider more complicated scenarios. This is one example of a relationship, but there is a general rule for how to take to create new clusters given some more complicated seed quiver. Because, for example, we could start with something, you know, that's like this. Right, so we could start with this seed quiver and then mutate on all these nodes and get some new clusters and some new quivers. And in general, you might get back to where you started, and you might not. There are infinite cluster algebras where you can just keep mutating all the livelong day, and you get an infinite structure. But there are also nice finite ones like this. And the general rule is quite simple. And I'll just put it here just to prove that it's simple. I won't describe it too much. But if you're mutating, let's say you're mutating on a node k, then the ith x-coordinate changes in the following way. Well, it's 1 over if I equals k. So again, the node you mutate on inverts. And then if it's a different node, you get this simple simple function here, simple rational function in the xi, where this bik is just the number of arrows between I and k. So, and then the sign of bik is dependent on the direction of the arrow. And there's a rule for also how to change the arrows change under mutation as well. It's a similarly simple rule. So again, there's this simple rule for mutation, and it works on a general quiver, and you can just play this game. That's really what the theory of cluster algebras is you just write down some seed quiver, and you mutate on all the nodes, and you keep mutating, and you just see what you get. So maybe this doesn't sound very exciting, but mathematicians think this is really the bee's knees. And I'll try and give some indication of why physicists like it as well. Now, okay. This is a simple example. What does it really have to do with anything? Well, one indication that this might be worthwhile to study in connection with polylogarithms is something that's been known since the 1800s, so well before cluster algebras were a thing, which is actually that these 5 coordinates entered as arguments of Li 2 give you 0, and this squiggly line just means modulo products of powers. This is Abel's identity. So already, this is sort of an indication, and Abel found it through I don't know how. But once you see cluster algebras, you can see directly that this is true. So this is one indication that there might be a connection between polylogarithms and cluster algebras. And I should note that this quiver is, of course, the A2 quiver. And so we call this the A2 cluster algebra. Okay, so that's one example. But so here we noted that another connection between polylogarithms and cluster algebras is that this coproduct always has x coordinates as its as their entries. And this is a non-obvious statement, precisely because I don't know if you can still see it up here. But for example, this coproduct of Li 2 2, if x and y are x coordinates, then you get x times y, which is not a priori an x coordinate. So you'd have to kind of tune your arguments in here to generate something. And there are like a ton of terms that include more complicated things like one minus xy over x. Okay, so how are you going to guarantee that this is also an x coordinate? And it's a very non-obvious statement even to mathematicians that these objects should exist at all. And so motivated by this, we define the following object, which is a cluster polylog. Okay, so a cluster polylog is some element f in L4. I'm going to restrict my definition to weight 4. There are probably generalizations to higher weight, but I don't want to speculate on that right now. So just L4, and it satisfies the property that the coproduct on f involves only x coordinates of some given cluster algebra. So this definition is sort of tailored so that we can now say that the two-loop endpoint amplitudes are cluster polylogarithms of GR4n. So that's a statement we can now make because we've tailored this definition to be nice in that respect. But now we want to ask the question, are there more sort of elemental cluster polylogarithms? In particular, does a simple cluster algebra such as this, does this admit any cluster polylogarithms? Is there any kind of, this is a weight 2 function that is associated with this. Is there a weight 4 function? And so, let's see, where should I do this? Okay, so what we have to do then, rear in the middle, can I do that? All right, sorry. So I wish that were closer. But the basic idea is we want to write down a general element of the coproduct and hit it with delta and solve and see if there are any solutions. In particular, we just want to write down some general element. Let's write this as so we have five x coordinates. Xi. So we can write down some completely general element of the coproduct, and then we just hit it with delta and solve for 0. So we solve these free parameters and see if there are any solutions. And this is a very simple problem in linear algebra. And in doing so, we find something really amazing, which is that there's actually only one solution. Okay, so it's amazing that there is more than 0, and it's amazing that there's less than 2. So the solution is quite simple. So the solution is just you put a very strange factor of j here, and then you get. So this is the solution to the integrability constraint, and it's a unique solution for that cluster algebra. And so, okay. Now, the particular form of this is quite strange, right? There's this J here, but the important fact is that this is unique. And so we call this the pentagon function, because this this cluster algebra makes up a pentagon when you draw out the five clusters. Okay, so since I'm running kind of low on time here, I'll then say, okay, for this cluster algebra, we have one solution. What about other cluster algebras? Do other cluster algebras admit multiple solutions? In particular, you know, what are the space of cluster polylogs for GR4-7? But before we do that, let's just start with something a bit simpler, which is just A3. So A3, of course, is just this seed quiver, where I use y's instead of x's just to distinguish the two. And so we can generate a cluster algebra here. In particular, you can just imagine, let me just forget about Y3. And now we just have this basically an A2 subalgebra, right? And so this generates a new, this generates a pentagon in of itself just by doing the same prescription. But you have this third element here, and you can mutate on that node as well. So you can mutate, and you get a new collection over here. You get a new one over here. So essentially, each cluster has three mutations you can do on it. And you can play this game, and eventually, this the space of clusters closes up. Okay, and so it closes with 15 x-coordinates and 14 clusters. And what it looks like is sort of this. So what is this picture? In this picture, each vertex is a cluster, and then each line represents a mutation. Okay, so you can see here there are five pentagons, or six pentagons, sorry, and these correspond with essentially six A2 subalgebras. And then furthermore, you see we have these three squares. Okay, these squares are essentially A1 times A1 subalgebras. And the way you generate those is by the fact that, for example, here, Y1 and Y3 don't talk to each other. So you can mutate here. That flips Y3, changes Y2, but Y1 is unchanged. And then you can mutate here, flip Y1, flip Y3, flip Y1, and then you're back to where you started. So it's a sequence of length 4 that gets you back to where you started. And that's denoted by this square. So in some sense, you can think of kind of y1 goes to y2. This pair is associated with pentagons. And the pair y1, y3 is some square. OK. And so this is the structure. And we call this the Stashev polytope for A3. Yeah.
The first example that you gave, the simple one, has nothing to do with amplitude. Is this correct?
Well, no, it will. So, yeah. So the question. Well, I'll let me. It'll just take 2 seconds. So the statement we want to now ask is, given this space of 15 coordinates, 14 clusters, can we generate a cluster polylogarithm in this new space? But naturally, we know there are going to be at least six solutions, namely the six pentagons, basically that function evaluated on each pentagonal face. There are six pentagon functions associated with this algebra. But you might ask, well, I have a lot more freedom here. Are there other solutions? And the answer is that there aren't. So for this cluster algebra, you only get pentagon functions, and there's no other solutions to satisfy the integrability constraint. And we've checked for all available cluster algebras that we can computationally do that pentagon functions are the only solution you will ever get. So no matter how complicated your cluster is, you never get new solutions. It's always just pentagonal faces of this polytope for your whatever cluster algebra you're dealing with. In particular, for GR4n, you might have some very complicated, in this case, the Sacheff polytope is huge. It's like six-dimensional, many faces, many subdimensions, codimension spaces, all that jazz. But there's a very natural basis for cluster pile logarithms, which is just the pentagons. So the pentagons, in some sense, provide a very natural basis to write down this coproduct. So in particular, we can write this as just a sum over pentagons of GR4/7. And in general, we expect this to be true for n particles. So this provides a very natural basis of functions, which completely sort of characterizes the coproduct and therefore the function. But in just the last 2 seconds, I'll just say one really beautiful property is that, so if you think about, briefly, if you look at these two terms, you have xi plus 1 and xi. Okay, these always appear in the same cluster, right? These are always just basically labeled, you know, one of the vertices of that pentagon is xi and xi plus 1. So in this sense, we call these guys, these terms are local. Okay, these correspond directly to clusters. They're in the same cluster on a pentagon. However, here, xi and xj can range all over the place. And you can have x1, which is at the top, talking to x4 at the bottom. Okay, so this is non-local in clusters. You have objects in different clusters talking to each other. But there's a really amazing observation, which is that when you calculate this guy, some magic happens, and the arguments that you get here are always in the same cluster. So some basically these Li 2 identities occur, and you can always write it as objects that are in the same cluster. So the coproduct is completely local. So there's some additional structure here. And in particular, the two variables that appear are always associated with square faces. They're always this y1, y3 that are in the same cluster, but they aren't connected, and so they make a square. So you can actually very naturally write this as a sum of what we call A3 functions, which is essentially, here you have six pentagons and you have three squares. And you can define a function associated with these guys, which completely naturally writes down, captures the coproduct for any n, and is very short. For example, n equals 7, there are two of these functions, which in addition to their cyclic images, generate the full space. So it's a very beautiful situation. It completely captures the cluster structure of these cluster algebras. These small, very simple cluster algebras are a natural basis for the coproduct of the endpoint two-loop MHV amplitude. And so with that, I know I'm a bit over, and I'll stop. Sorry, it's just a lot of material.
How do these 15 coordinates look like? So these are the 15 coordinates for the hexagon, right?
Yeah, these are hexagon. Yeah, so this is the 15 for hexagon. So yeah, for A3 is associated with GR4/6.
So for the hexagon, this is not yet relevant. For the
No, you don't. That's the beauty. The beauty is that the hexagon appears to be the fundamental building block, even of n equals 7. So you evaluate it on a bunch of, for GR47, you have a bunch of these as subalgebras, and you evaluate these functions on the subalgebras, and that provides a basis.
So for 7 points, we have 6 independent cross ratios, right?
Yeah, algebraically independent, yeah.
But now you are saying that the best way to express the answer, however, is to use an overcomplete base with many more cross ratios.
So the key is that we don't want, so algebraically independent, but we don't want to write them, in overcomplete in the sense that we only get x coordinates and not functions of x coordinates.
Well, I'm happy with that. I just want to know which x coordinates appear for the heptagon.
So for the heptagon, there are a total of 385 x coordinates.
385.
And 235 appear in the answer.
285, and which ones are those? What's the rule for?
We don't know the rule specifically for that subset. So for example, for the hexagon, there are 15 total x coordinates, not algebraically, but just 15 that appear in GR46.
So these are all the brackets you can make, basically.
It's a subset of the ratios. So the x coordinates are ratios, and there are 15 that you get, these 15, but only 9 appear in the final answer, and we don't know why.
So let me ask, if you have a geometric cross ratio, if you apply a cyclic rotation,
yes.
Does it map an x coordinate to an x coordinate?
Yes.
So
yes.
If it's positive, it continues to be positive after a cyclic rotation?
Yeah.
That's a bit confusing because when you cyclic rotate, it changes the order of the rows, so don't you pick minus signs from there?
I guess amazingly, no.
Okay.
Yeah. So the space of x coordinates
so
is.
The number is smaller than the number of ratios that you can make?
Yes, exactly. Because, I mean, for example, let's just, if you ignore positivity and just say the nice ratios are ratios that satisfy, that you can take 1 plus the ratio and get a new ratio, there are 90 different ratios at n equals 6. But only 15 of them are x coordinates. Because positivity restricts that further. And then at n equals 7, there are something like 2,000 plus or minus 100 that satisfy just this 1 plus constraint. And amazingly, only 385 of them are x coordinates.
So can you make an ansatz for how far are you from getting the full R27? Is this really the hard part? Now I think.
So R27, we have weight 4 in the paper, and then for lower weight, we can just make some conjecture in terms of x coordinates, and I'm sure if I sat down and I just wrote up some Mathematica code, I could do it in a day. But the goal is not to do that, because we want to find the right. So we want to impose some more cluster algebraic structure, and we don't understand how to do that for weight less than 4. So I could certainly fit some collection of Lie 3s and logs with x coordinates as arguments and get it to all weight, but I don't know if it would be the right way to do it. So we're kind of, maybe that'll happen in the next few weeks if I get around to it. But again, it's just amazing that really the hexagon appears to be this 6, this case really is the fundamental building block of the n particle answer. And actually, we have this L2 wedge L2. We actually have an all n formula for it. We just don't have the L3 wedge L1 component yet. And once we have it, then we can combine it into these nice types of functions. But really, the beauty is that the whole cluster algebraic structure, not just the coordinates, but the whole relationships they satisfy, are uniquely built into these functions. These are polylogarithms that really encode the entire structure of the cluster algebra. And these functions provide a very natural basis for two-loop MHV amplitudes. And there's no reason why any of this should be true. Any more questions?